Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Rich Eichholz. Rich is a candidate for the position of United States Representative in Congress in Washington. He is running on the Democratic ticket and primary coming up in August. Rich Eichholz, With Respect. Rich, how are you today?
I'm doing fine. This is a great, wonderful day. We've had some dodgy weather over the last few months, so
oh, yeah.
It's really nice to be out here.
The trite phrase is, but we live in Michigan.
Yeah.
But it's true.
Yeah, right.
why do we live in this state, especially in the wintertime? And because we like it, or
because we love it, really. But
because we love it.
Yeah.
Or we're masochists. We don't know. One of the others.
I'm going for the love it.
All right. Rich, where are you from?
Well, actually, I grew up in Hyde Park in Chicago. I'm from Union Pier now. It was a 20-year saga trying to move over here after graduate school. And then my wife got a great job in Chicago, which ended up we moved there because I wanted to live with her.
Mm-hmm. So, that's always a good thing.
And then, but part of the deal was that we would figure out a way to move over here eventually to get onto the other side of the lake. So basically, I've pretty much lived all my life, except for when I was at school, about half a mile from the lake.
And where did you go to school?
So undergraduate at Cornell and graduate school at the University of Illinois in Champaign.
Now, where are you
There
from?
Wasn't much water down in Champaign, just a little Boneyard Creek, I think it's called.
Where did you come from originally?
Yep, so I did grow up in Hyde Park.
You actually lived in Hyde Park to start?
Yep,
with?
Yep, okay. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Because I'm from Chicago originally and moved out here many years ago, but the people in this area are from Chicago, so there's a simpatico there. So, where did you go to college, and what kind of a degree did you get?
So I went to Cornell University for undergraduate, and there I got a degree in government. But I had a minor in a couple of other things, which including biology.
Mm-hmm.
And then for graduate school, science kind of won out, and I went to graduate school in biology, cell biology, to be specific. And that was at the University of Illinois, as I said.
Mm-hmm. What did you do after college?
So after college, about halfway through graduate school, I kind of recognized that academia was not going to be for me, and kind of started looking around, and I got involved in a company that was actually the first spinoff from Margaret Thatcher's privatization initiative.
Hmm.
She spun off the Atomic Energy Agency as a healthcare and radiochemical research products corporation. And I worked for that company for 13 years, started off as in research and directing a couple of the research labs and applications lab and so forth. And then I started drifting over into marketing and directing the research institute it was called Amersham International in terms of product development.
Was that located in Britain or
It
here?
Was located in Britain, yep. The company was based in a suburb of London.
Named?
Amersham.
Oh, okay. All right.
So, and I would spend basically for several years, I commuted back and forth once a month, about a week at a time in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that the Red Cross stopped taking my blood because they were, I passed the limit for how much time you could spend in the UK concern being mad cow disease.
Oh, that's right. I remember that. I spent a lot of time in London over the years and in the UK over the years, and each of their crises I identify with. I was there during the IRA bombing campaign in Christmas of 73. It was the coal strikes, the power strikes, the mad cow, everything. It's amazing the island survives with all of the crises that they've had to deal with. So, government though, you're running for the the United States Congress. You have also a spouse. Do you have any children as well?
I do have a spouse, and I have one child. Jim is our one and only child, a son, 27. He's now actually joined us in the campaign and helping full-time as a field director for the mm-hmm. campaign.
Why? Why are you doing this?
Why am I running?
Yeah.
So I think, honestly, if you could go back a long time to my college days, you can see I have an undergraduate degree in government, so I was very interested in government and how government works and why it works and you know why is it important and all that. But most of my professional career was really spent in business, and I was just really focused and busy. And I kind of kept involved in campaigns all the time, you know, but just basically doing grunt work, knocking doors, and we used to, you know, stuff envelopes. I know nobody does that anymore, but those kinds of things.
Now you keep your fingers dancing on the computer.
Yeah. But then about, I would say, if you really look at it, about 20 years ago, that's really where the seeds of me running started. And I came up with, actually two obsessions. I call them hobbies, but my wife called them obsessions. And one was trying to figure out a way to move over here. So we bought a place, as we had agreed that we would buy a place here. And about 20 years ago, we started rebuilding it so that we could actually move over here at some point. And that was one obsession. But the other obsession was that I started, I was struck by the apparent relationship between income vitality and economic vitality and income disparity. I really started using some of my mathematical skills and forecasting skills and analytical skills to go back and look at what's been going on. And what I found at that point in time, it was really just about 3 decades worth of data. It's now 5 decades worth of data. And basically what's been happening in our country is that the economic vitality as measured by GDP per population.
Stop, GDP.
Oh, sorry, gross domestic product.
Okay.
Per person. So when the parameter of gross domestic product was developed at a conference in the early 20th century, the people coming out of that conference said, we do not want GDP, gross domestic product, being used as a measure of economic vitality. They didn't think it was a good idea. But the nearest one that most economists accept is if you divide it by the population, then it's a little bit more representative of what's actually going on. And mm-hmm. so if you measure that, if you follow that measure, at that time for 3 decades, basically, on a very gross level, just overall trend, it's going down. It was going down the whole time. It's continued to go down the whole time now as well. So that's now after 5 decades now.
Now, when you say gross domestic product, that's the total value of the goods and services that our country produces in a year.
In a year, right.
That's without any deductions for anything.
Right.
That's the gross part.
Yep.
And it's us as opposed to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, again, product, which is the combination of goods and services
Absolutely.
Produced.
Yep.
Then you divide that by the number of people we have in the country.
That's right.
Raw numbers.
Mm-hmm.
That which includes men, women, adults, kids, whatever.
Right.
Does that also include people who are in the workforce but are not legal aliens?
It includes everybody in the population.
Okay.
Yep. So residents,
You divide that into the gross domestic product,
mm-hmm.
and now you come up with a number, and this is
yep.
the number
and
you're
this
talking
is a number,
about.
This is a number that is... I mean, there are other parameters that economists use, but this is one that is used fairly frequently. It was one that, at the time, I had, I still have a couple of economists who are friends, and I asked them what parameter would actually be a good measure for vitality, and that's kind of that was the consensus to use that, and so that's what I used. And if you just follow that, it's been just going down for 5 decades now. And at the other hand, if you look at the income disparity. By any of a number of measures, but that's been going up. So we, about in the 1960s, we were halfway between Denmark and China in terms of income disparity. And now we're really close to China. Part of that is because China's come down. They're not, you know, their income disparity is not as great as it used to be.
Explain what income disparity is, because that's an interesting concept.
Yep. So thanks for asking, because most people don't ask, okay? But basically, it's just taking the whole income that the population has and dividing it into what proportion of people, you know, you've heard the argument about the 1% and so forth, mm-hmm. right? So that's, you look at what percent of the 1% of the population, mm-hmm. you know, what percent of the income do they have? Mm-hmm. And so if it's perfectly even, where everyone gets the, you know, the same income, then that's absolute parity, mm-hmm. right? But as that gets distorted and pushed up and pushed down, and then you get the income disparity, just to try to be simple about it.
But so between the rich and the poor?
Yeah, between the rich and the poor.
High income, low income.
Honestly, even if you look at Denmark, it does not have an income disparity that is even, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's income disparity in Denmark, and there has always been income disparity in the United States, and there always will be. And there, by the way, there has to be, because there has to be pools of money available for investment, and yet you still want everyone to be able to participate in the economy. So the problem isn't that we have income disparity per se, it's the extent of the income disparity. And in the 1960s, we had a balance between the proportion of the income that was coming to the profit side of things and the proportion of the income that was coming to the wages side of things. It was a really good mm-hmm. balance. We had a high single-digit GDP growth per population. That was a very vibrant economy. And what we've been doing for five decades, one policy decision after another, is just keep pushing the money from one side of the equation over to the other side of the equation so that we now have an imbalance. And, you know, when we talk about redistribution, it's not to try to make sure that everybody has a Rolex or anything like that. It's just to make sure that everyone in the country can participate in the economy.
If you had to pick a number at which you would say is the optimum mm-hmm. split in disparity, because you say the disparity is important.
Right.
And the place where we're at right now, what would those two numbers be?
Yep. So the parameter that is most commonly used, I would say 0.34. So it goes from 0 to 1, the parameter. Mm-hmm. And I would say that in the 60s, we were right at between 0.32 and 0.34. And that's about right. Denmark, for example, was and is about 0.22. China was, I think, 0.6 in the 60s, and I think it's now down to 0.48 or something like that. We are now around 0.45. So, you know, honestly, what I think we need to do is...
Wait a minute. Sorry. Let me stop you. Mm-hmm. You said that 0.38 was where we were.
In the 60s we were at 0.32, 0.34.
Okay, in that range. And now we're up at 0.48.
0.42. Sorry, right, yeah, I'm throwing out too many numbers.
All right, but the question is, what does that represent in English terms?
Yeah.
I.e., how are the rich or the poor separated in those numbers?
Yep. So the higher the number, the greater the disparity.
Okay.
All right. So if it's at zero, then everybody has the exact same money. I'm sorry. I should have backed off.
Yeah. So if I was to have a country of total plutocrats and the oligarchs ruled everything, you would expect the number to be 0.78 or 0.8 or something
right,
like that.
Right. Exactly. Yep.
Because at 1.0, everybody in the top. Yeah, and nobody down below has
right.
anything.
Yeah, at 1.0, one person has everything.
All right,
and nobody has anything.
That's well, we're
right.
not
Thank
that.
You.
We're not to that point.
No,
yet. and we're not even above 50
no.
at this point.
Right.
We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, I'm going to talk to you about what it is that you think you can contribute to changing the equation which you have said is not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Right now, we're talking to Rich Eichholz, who is a representative for the 6th District for the United States Congress from southwestern Michigan, and he is involved in the Democratic primary to replace or to oppose current Congressman Fred Upton. He's from Union Pier, and we will be back in just a moment. This is John Smetanka on With Respect. We're now back on With Respect with Rich Eichholz, who is a person talking economic numbers, and he talks in terms of how our society needs to have a better balance, perhaps, than we have in terms of income and profit and salaries and whatever between our people. This is John Smetanka, and we're on With Respect. So, Rich, when we broke, you gave us a good estimate of what has motivated you to get into politics, this income disparity. What are you going to do about it? What thoughts do you have? We're going to be talking about, incidentally, a number of issues that are going to face this country and face congresspeople in addition to that. But let's talk about this particular aspect of your campaign.
Right. So just one more point about why I'm running, and then I think the two tie together.
Okay.
So, the other point is that when Fred Upton became our when Fred Upton was appointed to chairmanship of the Energy and Commerce Committee, I was actually pretty excited because I thought he's not a climate change denier, and he says he's all about business and so forth. And I don't see any conflict whatsoever between helping getting our economy moving again and saving our planet and our environment, because I think those two things go together very well. But in fact, what happened is he just basically doubled down on fossil fuels, and we've had no progress, literally no progress here in Southwest Michigan in particular, in terms of green energy. So where the two come together, I believe that the first thing we need to do, both for our planet and for our economy, is to start focusing on building a green energy-based economy that works on clean, renewable energy, and that provides a wealth of new jobs, all good-paying, rewarding jobs. Most of them are going to be right here. There are some jobs that are maybe offshored, but a lot of the actual management, design, implementation, and maintenance, building, construction of solar and wind-powered energy installations that will all take place here. So I think that's the first thing that we need to do, is to get the economy moving again by making sure that we're focused on something which is actually going to help our planet and help our economy at the same time. The other things we need to do is kind of look at, well, why did we get here? I mean, what were the policy decisions that changed all this? And we've had three massive tax cuts we've recovered from the last two times, and now we've had a third massive tax cut, which is we will recover from again, but it's going to take years to recover from. So we need to stop the tax cutting, especially for the wealthy and the major corporations. We need to reverse that. We don't need, crazy high taxes. We just need reasonable taxes, because the government is not the problem. And it's not always the solution, but the government is part of a good, solid economy. There are key roles that the government plays: schools, infrastructure, transportation, that are being shortchanged. And we need to make sure that we're funding those. The other thing is minimum wage. The Democrats were too clever by half in the 30s when they created the minimum wage law. They saw the reaction that they got at the polls when they passed the minimum wage law. People came out and voted for Democrats. So let's just keep doing that. And instead of indexing the minimum wage to inflation, every time we need one, we'll just pass it again, and we'll get more people to vote for us. But reality sets in, and you know what? It doesn't always happen. We can't always get it passed. And so now we have a minimum wage, which you know, it's way out of whack for inflation.
Why is that?
Because we haven't kept up, it has not kept up with inflation, the minimum wage. Every time, you know, we don't get to pass it every time because there are people who are opposed to it. So I think we need to get the minimum wage to a point where someone who's working full time can have a living wage that they can keep their, you know, keep their family going. Mm-hmm.
How would you define
and then index it. Right.
Okay. Yeah. But, all right. So let's pick a number. What would be the number today, if you could, that if in the best of all possible worlds, what would be the number of a minimum wage today that would be in your ballpark that you think would be appropriate?
So I think on a national average, mm-hmm. And I always have to caution people about average because, like a drunk walking down the highway at night, and he's walking on the yellow line. Trying to walk on the yellow line. On average, he's walking on the yellow line, but in reality, he's dead. So we have to be careful when we say average, okay? Mm-hmm. So, but I think national average would probably be something like $15 an hour, maybe a little bit higher, but probably something like $15 an hour. But that doesn't mean that it would be appropriate or even possible everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it has to be indexed for not only inflation, but also for geographic location and
cost of living,
the culture.
It costs more to live in New York and Los Angeles than it does in Dubuque or Grand Rapids or Union Pier.
Right, right. And so I think, you know, the Census Bureau has really good data on this, and I think there's no reason why the cost of living couldn't be inflated for, you know, the region.
Well, so, does
sorry,
that,
sorry, not inflated for, but yeah, adjusted for.
But
sorry.
I understand that. But just one point: if you were to have cost of living put into it, it's going to automatically appear that all the money is going to New York or Los Angeles because there can be the high minimum wage rates, and then the rest of the place, the rest of the great flyover, which is us, mm-hmm. Would be. Less attractive for people to live. Would that be
Well, but the cost of living is lower as well, and so I think that's the balance that people look at. I mean, people look at you know, where do I want to live on two bases, really. Mm-hmm. One, can I afford to live there? And two, do I want to live there? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, for me, it's real. The second one is real easy here. We should be able to attract a lot of people to live mm-hmm. here. So that part's easy. And so the other part is just to make sure that the cost of living is in balance with the with the wage structure there.
All right. Now, one issue that you raised, which was the interrelationship between green energy and a good economy. And forward-looking a kind of approach, and jobs. I don't understand this. Maybe you can help me. If we increase the number of jobs in the area of green energy, that is wind, solar, and whatnot, tidal, and we go away from fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. Is there not a balance between the loss of jobs in the fossil fuels area? Because there's a whole economy. Part mm-hmm. of our economy mm-hmm. is derived from the automobile and coal and whatnot. And then you switch it over to non-fossil fuels. Aren't you just shifting jobs from one to the other as opposed to creating more?
Yep. So actually, it takes more jobs in green energy. Solar, wind, okay. takes more jobs per kilowatt than do fossil fuels.
Okay.
So, and that number is actually hard to pin down. You can find estimates that range anywhere from 5 to 37 more, you know, times jobs. I don't believe the 37. I think they've left off factors, but I think the 5 is probably pretty close. To the ratio, mm-hmm. and so then you would say, well, then it's just going to be more expensive. But 70% of the cost of producing a kilowatt using fossil fuels is the fuel, and mm-hmm. that's not jobs. The jobs mm-hmm. is some part of the 30% that's left over. So there's plenty of room economically to pay more people. So basically, we're paying people to produce, to do more work, to produce the same amount or more energy. But it's going into jobs rather than just paying for the fossil fuel.
So the thrust of your interest in running is to make this all work, to reduce income disparity, to, I presume, also to increase gross domestic product divided by population.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
And the three working together produces a better society.
Yep. And okay. And I what I want to say is that you know, GDP per population parameter, you know, right now in this district, we're at basically 0%. And I see it everywhere I go. And you don't actually need the numbers. You can just, when I'm talking to someone on the north side of Kalamazoo, and like a single father of two, and he works full time for minimum wage, and he's embarrassed because he doesn't have the money for siding on his house. Or the mom in Benton Harbor who's looking forward to her son coming home from the Army after 20 years, but worried that he's not going to have a job when he gets here.
What does it mean, 0%?
0% growth, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So yeah, in the time that, I forgot because usually I have already said this, in the time that Fred Upton has been our congressman, growth in our economy has gone from 2% down to 0%.
Okay.
Literally
0%. Now
sorry.
I understand what you're talking
sorry.
About.
Thank you for catching that.
There are other issues that are out there, and as a congressperson, mm-hmm. you're going to have to face the big shaboom. And the big shaboom is, do you vote your conscience or do you vote your constituents' interests?
Right.
They may be the same,
yep.
but every so often there's a difference. And which way do you go?
Right. So first of all, before I decided to run here, mm-hmm. I did a lot of interviewing of people all over the district. I know that most of the people in Kalamazoo are probably going to agree with me on most things. That was fairly easy. But the thing I wanted to make sure about was that the moderate Republicans and the independents out in the district, in the outlying areas, that I'm also representative of them. Because I don't really want to be in that situation where, you know, my conscience tells me one thing and my constituents want me to do something different.
It's going to happen.
But
I warn you.
But I understand that it'll happen. But the point I'm trying to make is that I believe that I am a match for the district. And so I do think the number of times that it is going to happen is going to be small. But I agree as well that it will happen. And here's what I'll do. I will actually vote the way that I believe that I need to vote.
Okay.
Fair. But I just want to say that I will be out in the district holding town halls, explaining to people why I'm doing it before I do it, and I will come back out after I do it as well to make sure that everyone knows that I've at least heard and understood where they're coming from.
You've talked about, in general terms, about your goals, and I'm going to bounce off a few issues, and I'm not trying to throw them at you in the last seconds. We have about 3 minutes to go. But just to toss out a couple, one of the big issues in the past 5 years has been the question of immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And the immigration, by that I mean people coming into the country, obviously. Some come in according to the law, and some people don't follow the rules exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a movement to take those people who didn't come in, having dotted every I and crossed every T and crossed the border, whatever, and getting them out. So what is your view on this balance that has to take place between legal entries and illegal entries?
Yeah. So I think the first thing to do is to recognize the kind of hypocrisy that we've seen on this issue, because there are plenty of people on the business side who have actually been encouraging mm-hmm. this kind of immigration that isn't, undocumented immigration, whereas other people, you know, obviously are opposed to it. And I believe that we want an immigration system where pretty much everyone, there are rules and everyone follows the rules. But we've had the system going for a while, And I think we need to recognize that it's been out of whack. I don't think we should be thinking at all about, you know, pushing people back out. We should figure out a way to get them on the right side of the law and here permanently. But I also, at the same time, do believe that it's perfectly appropriate to be making sure that our borders are secure and that we have a better system to welcome immigrants, because we need more immigrants. That's another misunderstanding. We have a lot of people retiring, going into Social Security. They need workers, and the only way to get those workers would be immigrants.
Rich Eichler, thank you very much. There's so much more to talk about, but I'm sure you're going to be talking about many of the issues that are out there in the campaign trail. Thank you very much for joining us. This is With Respect, and we've been talking to Rich Eichler, who is the
Eichholz,
who is the is a candidate, one of six candidates for the position of United States Representative in Congress. Yeah. This is John Smetanka, and With Respect, and we will be right back. Hello. Our second guest today is David Banach. David is also a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the 6th District United States Congressional seat. He is running for that nomination, and at the end, the candidate who is chosen in that primary will run against the incumbent, Fred Upton. David Banach, With Respect. David, how are you today?
Doing well, John. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be down here in Harbor Country.
Good. We're glad to have you. So, David, where are you from originally?
Originally, I'm from up north, from Alpena, and been down in Kalamazoo for a few years now, and really excited about making Southwest Michigan home. It's been really a great place to learn, to meet new people, and to find some new exciting activities.
Were you, what kind of an upbringing did you have?
Yeah, so I grew up, like I said, in northern Michigan. My family has a family farm, and so my grandparents have been farming, and that farm's been in the hands, same family hands, for about 150 years. Hmm. They did dairy until they retired, which, you know, retiring for a farmer is going from dairy to beef cattle. Yeah. And then my parents have a small farm, more along the lines of almost like a homestead today, but my dad pays the bills with a sawmill, so I grew up, you know, working on my family farm and in my dad's sawmill.
How about your family? You got your dad does family farming and sawmill, but what about your mom?
My mom was a nurse when I grew up. She had an LPN when I was young. She quit to, you know, raise the kids. We've got four siblings. So she quit to raise the kids, get us through school, and to help out in sawmill. So it's a family activity.
What are your siblings? Are boys, girls?
I've got two of each. Both of my brothers. So my parents really believed in education as a crucial thing for us. In order to pay for the bills to get us through college, we actually raised Christmas trees and sold Christmas trees as a way to pay for college for all five of us. And my two brothers, one of them is now a farmer, the other drives log trucks for a living. Both of them did something different in college, and that's one of the things that's really important to me to think about. So one of my brothers, the one who drives log trucks, got a degree in engineering, and the one who's a farmer got a degree in forestry. Neither one of them wanted to do that. We just live in a society where it's assumed that the only way to succeed is to go to college. Mm-hmm. And that's one reason I think that we need to do a lot better with trade schools and vocational programs, because both my brothers would have been better served if they had been able to do the thing they wanted right from the beginning, instead of spending time trying to chase what they thought was what we're supposed to do.
Yeah. What about your sisters?
So my sisters are both teachers. My youngest sister teaches math at a community college, and something I completely don't comprehend. And then my older sister is one of these people who has tried and found out how difficult a lot of different things are. She worked in nursing for a while. She was a registered nurse. Worked in a home for people with disabilities for a while. And those things were, it was just too much was demanded of her. Mm-hmm. And So she went and moved over into teaching, which, of course, is another thing where we're seeing it's much too, the demands are too high, the reward is too low. And I think that that's, again, it's another thing we absolutely, if we want the best teachers in this country, we need to treat them that way. We need to give better benefits, better pay, and we need to actually do something that's going to recruit teachers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how about yourself? What did you do after you went to Alpena High School?
Yep. So from day one of my student career and teaching, I've been in public schools. So Alpena Public to Michigan State to Indiana to Missouri to finish up all my education. And my first teaching job was down in Louisiana. Just like a lot of people in Michigan, you have to leave the state a lot of times to find a good job. And that's something we have to change. So I taught in Louisiana for a while and then was able to come back up here and teach in Kalamazoo. So I've been a teacher for a long time.
Where are you? So you got a degree where?
I got degrees from Michigan State, Indiana, and Missouri.
All of them, okay.
Correct, so through grad school.
Now, you're embarked on a political effort, and this, I can say from personal experience, is challenging. The question is, why? Why do you want to do what you're doing as far as campaigning, difficult, but also when you become congressperson, mm-hmm. if you are elected, that also is not an easy job. There's a lot of travel involved, mm-hmm. and all. This is a surrendering of your privacy.
Yeah.
Why are you doing it?
Well, you hit on a really good point there. It's something that I don't think very many people recognize is really just how hard this is. This is the hardest thing that my wife and I have ever done. You're right, we've sacrificed every moment of our lives because we're running a grassroots campaign, so we're doing a lot and we have volunteers, and that means we're going to lots of events every single day. And it is, it's very, very difficult, it's very time consuming and stressful. But I'm doing it because I feel like I need to. Before I got into this, I'd been active in environmental issues, really a lot of environmental justice things, and never saw myself delving into partisan politics. Yeah. And I felt that way until Senator Sanders announced he was going to run for president. I had known of Sanders for a long time. I'd started following him when he voted against the Iraq War because I was really appreciative and I saw that as a moment of leadership. We have too few real leaders of political elected officials. And that was an unpopular decision at the time, but it was the decision he felt was the moral decision, and he did it. And so he announced he was going to run for president. And I got very involved in the campaign, knocked on thousands of doors, made the phone calls, organized other volunteers, and we saw the success of that. And I saw the success of what a grassroots movement can do, where Sanders won the 6th district in Michigan with the highest win margin of any congressional district in the state of Michigan. And that's really one of the things that pushed him forward in the primary. And because
that was in the primary?
Correct. And for the work that I'd done for the Sanders campaign here, I was lucky enough that he chose me as one of three people from the state to represent progressive reform on the Democratic National Platform Committee. While I was there, I saw all the things that I hoped the Democratic Party could achieve get voted down one after another. We were trying to get the cap lifted, well, not even completely lifted, just raised on Social Security taxes, so it'd be more solvent. But right now, it's $125,000, I think, approximately, of your income is taxed for Social Security. Anything you make above that, you don't pay any Social Security tax on.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just trying to raise that level to $250,000.
Okay, so you're going to double that. Go ahead.
And we're trying to also index Social Security to inflation, so it'd actually be something that people could use for retirement. We are trying to get Glass-Steagall reinstated in banking.
What?
Glass-Steagall, so a much more effective banking regulation that, in kind of the simplest terms, prevents banks from speculating on stocks with people's investments, with their life savings. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things that, because we'd gotten rid of it, is one of the reasons why the 2008 crash was able to happen. Yeah, we're trying to get bans on natural gas power plants and trying to shut down some of the pipeline projects. We wanted to end the Import-Export Bank, which is one of these things that's really just a subsidy of the biggest corporations, like places like Boeing, use it to get huge loans to open factories overseas. So we were trying to get these things that were economic populist measures, things that would help every single American. And none of them passed. We couldn't get any of them into the platform committee or into the Democratic platform. And so I left there really disenchanted with what it meant to be a Democrat today. And looking back over the past decade or so, Democratic Party's lost over 1,000 seats in state legislatures and in the U.S. legislature. And I think that that comes back to a lack of leadership at the national level. So really the reason I'm running is because we have fallen into this place that I feel like instead of having elections, we're having auctions. And it's just whatever candidate comes to the table with the biggest stack of money is just presumed to be the best candidate. And that candidate often doesn't have any stance on issues or any real desire to help the working class Americans. And that's what this race to me is about, is trying to fight back against the purchasing of our democracy by the wealthiest and by the corporations.
Well, it's funny you mention that because, pardon me, there is a candidate somewhere, sometime, who I think he was probably trying to be funny, but he was running for Congress, and he suggested that he would be happy to wear sports coats with his sponsors on the sleeve or on the back or in the front. And then change them every so often, so that everybody, all of his sponsors, would get a break and get some attention. Would you think that would be a good idea? How about the little guys? You know,
I think it'd be funny. At one point, we had done a graphic online that did like a NASCAR style jacket.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And showed all the different big corporate donors to the Upton campaign. Mm-hmm. And I think that people need to become a lot more aware of those types of things, because with corporations and corporate lobbyists purchasing our legislators, how do we expect them to actually act in the best interest of people?
Would you apply that equally to, say, the labor unions?
Yes. So labor unions are an interest group.
Yes, they are.
And they have the ability to contribute money through PACs. And so I have vowed I'll take no corporate PAC money. But I do support unions. And I think that unions are the only bargaining or the only protection that the working class has against ownership, against people who have the big corporate wealth. And yeah, you know, I've been a union member since the first day I started teaching, and since I got to Michigan from day one, I've been an elected representative to my union's council. So it's something that to me is absolutely critical, is bringing back the power of unions.
So that would include not taking any money from unions.
I take money from unions because I don't see them as corporations.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what other things are you interested in highlighting about your reasons for running?
I'd say the biggest thing for me is the money in politics. That's the underlying problem. But then we have to look at how we can help people. And to me, that's what this has to be about. So for me, the number one issue is healthcare. And not some nebulous universal healthcare. What we need is a true single-payer universal healthcare system that simply covers every single person in this country, and there is no cost at the point of service. We have to do that if we want to actually have healthcare that works, instead of having a healthcare system that is designed around corporate profits and the federal, you know, programs such as the ACA, which are great. Believe me, I will protect the ACA every single day until we can get a single-payer system, because the ACA is the best thing that we've ever had.
Is there a single-payer system out there around the world? Because there's a number of single-payer
right.
systems that you would think is the ideal that you would like to see us go to. And I'm not suggesting that you should do it tomorrow. I'm
right.
just saying, what is your, you know, what do you think in the long run should be going to? Sweden, Britain, Canada, France, whatever.
I like the system they have in Canada, but it's one of these things where we have to find the way that it works for the United States, because we're a much larger country, much more populous country, with a much more longstanding and complicated healthcare system. So we are not going to simply be able to adopt another country's model.
Okay.
But I do like Canada as a place to start.
What else would you be interested in your goals in going into Congress?
One of the things that I see as a way we can help a lot of people is through a new agricultural policy. So right now, our agricultural system is built around this model that we've had since the end of World War II, which is go big or go home. The number of farms is decreasing. The size of each of those farms is increasing. The large corporate ownership is increasing on these farms. Farmers have the highest suicide rate of any demographic in the United States because of the difficulties. Our entire farming model is being based on this monocrop, chemical-intensive, highly mechanized, and very expensive system. And the only way that farmers can stay in business is with substantial subsidies from the United States government to grow commodity crops that they ship overseas.
Mm-hmm.
So my proposal is that I'm not saying we need more money for farm subsidies. I'm saying we need to be much wiser, and we need to start incentivizing farmers to switch to sustainable and family farm or small farm systems that are diverse and sustainable. So we need to be growing food. If we start growing food on smaller farms, it's more diversified, we're going to create employment in rural areas, we're going to create more jobs in rural areas, and we're going to create business opportunities as well, and have healthier food for people to eat.
We're going to take a break right now. We're talking with David Banach, who is a candidate for the Democratic nomination for Congress in the 6th Congressional District of Michigan. This is John Smetanka on With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with David Banach, who is a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the 6th Congressional District of the state of Michigan for the U.S. Congress. This is John Smetanka. Now, David, when we broke, you had, because of your background in farming, that's something that you also feel very strongly about. And the family farm, getting the family farm back. I'm not exactly sure I understand how you define sustainable crops in mm-hmm. sustainable industry, farming industry.
And just to a point of clarity, so I do say family farm, but one of the things to keep in mind that a lot of corporate farms are simply family farms that have succeeded as they've grown and got bigger. So it's not anti-corporate farming in a sense. It's more in favor of a smaller scale type of a farming that's diverse and sustainable. So by diverse and sustainable, we need to grow multiple types of crops rather than just grow, you know, hundreds or thousands of acres of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then by sustainable, I would love to see more organic crops being grown, but not everything can be grown organically, and that's not necessarily the answer all the time. So by sustainable, I mean we need to be practicing farming in a way that if we look 100 years from now, that same farm with the same farming practices is going to be just as viable, just as productive as it is today. To me, that's the vision of sustainability.
Okay. Now, one issue that comes up all over the world, I teach in other parts of the country or the world, and when I hear about American crops is they are, there's too many GMOs. Genetically modified organisms, as I recall. Am I correct with
correct.
That? Okay. And we use different kinds of chemicals that the rest of the world doesn't find appropriate, or we use antibiotics in our cattle or sheep or whatever. What are your thoughts on those issues?
In a general sense, I'm not in favor of GMOs or genetically engineered crops. I don't think that we need to go down that route, and I think it's a route that is woefully it is not understood well enough. The science that is being done there is not conclusive, and it, in my opinion, it's not independent enough to be reliable. Yeah. But I don't believe that we can make a blanket statement that says GMOs are safe or GMOs are unsafe, because each one of them is a different product. and each one of them is going to have a different result. So I think we need really good, independent, verifiable science on every single one of these entities that is proposed.
Mm-hmm. This has always troubled me when I hear this debate, because it seems to me there's something missing, and I can't get you're helping me to get a grasp of it. But isn't when we create new brands of strawberries or wheat that are more rust resistant, mm-hmm. and that's what, isn't that a modification? Doesn't that fit in with that?
There's some debate in terms of how you would characterize this.
Okay.
Agriculture, by its very nature, the practice of agriculture is creating hybrids and breeding better strains of whether it's cattle or strawberries. Mm-hmm. And that's a very natural process, and that's what agriculture does. My concern is when we take genetic strands or pieces of genetic strands from one species and inject them into another one, mm-hmm. to change the characteristics of that species. That deviates from what can happen in nature, and we usually do not know what the long-term effects of that playing around with the genetic structure will be.
What other areas that your experience and your interest in campaigning for Bernie Sanders, mm-hmm. or being raised on the farm, or your educational, your teaching, mm-hmm. what else are you interested in?
So a couple of other big areas for me are infrastructure and education. So with infrastructure, I think that Mr. Trump hit on a good idea when he proposed the $1 trillion investment in infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good idea, and I absolutely believe that we need to do that. But we don't need to do it in the way that the president has gone forward with, which is mostly putting that cost onto states and municipalities and privatizing as much as possible. I'd like to see us do a WPA for the 21st century. Let's do a Works Progress Administration. Let's make this a federal jobs project. Let's put 11 million people to work. That is going to mean we can fix our water main so we don't have lead service lines. We can fix our stormwater runoff so our flooding isn't so bad. We can fix our roads, because we certainly need better roads. All these things are infrastructure projects. We put more into railroads, which gets the heavy truck traffic off of the interstates, which makes the interstates last longer and makes them safer to travel. These are all things we can do. We just need to have the political will to make that investment.
Where do we get the money for that? I mean, that's a lot. $1 trillion is a lot of money.
Absolutely.
And where does that come from?
It comes from thinking about our priorities. We just, I think the last military budget was something about $720 billion. Mm-hmm. When it was passed, there was essentially no debate. And that included more money for nuclear weapons than the military even wanted. I think, and then how many trillions of dollars have been invested in the F-35, the plane that's not even ready for combat. So I think that what we need to do is think about our priorities. And the military is a good example of that. I'm not in any way implying that we need to weaken national defense. I'm saying, though, what we need to do is think about where we're spending that money and where it needs to be spent. And I think that fixing our infrastructure here back in the United States should be a priority.
So you've taken one area, which is the defense budget. I'm sure there's other areas where you would want to see different priorities. Mm-hmm. But just as long as you raise the defense budget, what would you do, say, about the F-35? Because I know I just saw in the news that they've been delivered to some country in Europe. Mm-hmm. I don't remember which one. What would you do about that? Would you cut it out? Would you restrict the size of it? What would you do?
I would want to make that decision based on having discussions with the military experts and the defense contractor, so I know exactly all the information. From the vantage point I have today, I think we need to cancel the F-35 program. I think from the reading that I have done on it, mm-hmm. it looks like it is a poorly conceived combat platform, trying to have this one single plane that can be used as a bomber, as a fighter jet, they're trying to have a single plane that can basically do every single different military application, which is proving to be impossible. That's why this plane is not working, because they're trying to outfit it to have every single, they're trying to make it a Swiss Army knife, and it's just not, we can't. And so I think it's worth, at this point, we're throwing good money after bad.
What would be the area that, other than the military, you might want to adjust and take away some of its funding to put into the $1 trillion? Because even if you took out the entire defense budget or half of it, you're still short, well short of that $1 trillion that you want to put in.
But we look at the tax structure.
Okay.
One of the things that I think we could implement that would bring us billions of dollars per year and cause no hardship at all to the working class Americans would be we call it a financial transaction tax. A lot of different countries around the world have this. Essentially, it depends on the type of financial transaction, but you can think of it in simplified terms as, say, a sales tax on trading stocks and bonds. So it is something that's along the lines of 0.05% on Wall Street transactions, brings in billions of dollars to the country. Only 49% of the United States population owns any stocks at this point. So the only people who are going to be feeling any kind of taxation from this are the people who can absolutely afford it, and it's going to bring us a lot of money back into the federal treasury.
One of the boasts that the current administration has is they did a great job in reducing taxes and the income tax or whatever, or readjusting where it came from and so on. However you want to view what happened with the tax bill which passed this year. What are your thoughts about that?
I completely buy into the narrative of the tax scam, because what this tax bill does is it dramatically reduces taxes on the wealthiest and on the corporations, and it gives some tax relief to most other Americans. Now, the tax relief it gives to working Americans is temporary and minor in comparison to the billions of dollars of taxes that are going back to the wealthiest and to the corporations. And we're seeing this with corporations that, you know, particularly good example is Carrier, who Trump talked about, you know, saving all those jobs, and now they're offshoring them. Now you saw Harley Davidson just shipped a factory over to Thailand, I believe it was. You know, AT&T gave its employees a small bonus and then, you know, thousands of dollars back to shareholders. And we're seeing this all over the country. Is what's happening is more and more of our tax dollars are being diverted to the people who already have the most.
So would you switch it around? Would you have a tax bill which increased the taxes on corporations and did something else? What would you do?
We absolutely have to have a tax bill that is equitable. And what that means is the people who can't afford to pay more have to pay more. I mean, it just, there is no way around it. You live in a society, you have a cost of you paying your dues to be part of it. If the society has been that good to you to make you a multimillionaire, your taxes are going to go up.
One of the other issues that has caught a lot of attention, and some people would say demagoguery, is the question of immigration to this country. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that we're a nation of immigrants, and we need to remember that. I would like to see us make it easier and safer for people to immigrate here. We need to, I mean, I do not in any way condone the wall. I think that's a terrible idea. It's a waste of our money. I think we need to take our deportation infrastructure that we've created, and we need to just focus on people who are dangerous to our society, people who are criminals. Those are people we should stop from coming into the country. Those are the people who shouldn't be here. But anyone else who wants to come here, who wants to work, who wants to create a better life for themselves and their family, should be encouraged, and their path should be made easier.
So it was estimated during the 2016 campaign, and I always distrust numbers from that candidates toss out, but I think it is a fairly good estimate that we have between 13 and 20 million people who are here without having come in according to the rules that we set for all immigrants. So that's illegal or undocumented immigrants. What do you think about should happen to them?
One of the things I think we need to just put into this conversation is that people usually overlook the fact that most of the people who are here illegally are here because they have overstayed visas.
Okay.
So people who came here to work, people who came here for school, and stayed longer than they were supposed to. So most of our people who are here illegally were welcomed into this country and just overstayed their welcome. It's not people who've crossed the border illegally who are the majority. I think that we need to have all those people who are here have a path to citizenship. The last time we did anything along those lines, it was under Reagan. You know, if Reagan could grant amnesty to undocumented immigrants, why in the world can't we do that today? So I think we need to welcome these people in because they're going to help our communities.
David Benack, thank you very much. There's so many other things we could talk about, but you've been very candid and expansive about what your thoughts are. And thank you very much for spending time. I wish you the best in whatever happens. This is John Smetankin. We've been talking to David Benack, a candidate for the 6th U.S. Congressional District nomination for the Democratic Party. Remember that you should vote, whether it's the Democratic Party or the Republican Party or whatever party you want to be a part of, exercise your vote. This is John Smetanka, and remember our mantra, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.